So I want to welcome everyone to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. The main ideas that not only our ULT, but the ULTs that are around the world, what our plan is to spread, broadcast the ancient ideas that were put forth in writing by H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. These ideas, this philosophy, is timeless in its nature, with its main goal is to put forth the idea of universal brotherhood. And it is not an organization. We are a group of students who come together to help each other with the idea of learning these fundamental principles of this philosophy. And it's to help us not only to understand it when we're here, but when we go home, to independently study it so that we can put these ideas out to a world that so sorely needs them. So the basis for union is the similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. And we regard anyone as a theosophist whose idea is the true service of humanity. And we do not distinguish between any color, sex, country of origin, race, anything like that. Anyone who agrees with the ideas are welcome here, and it is free, open to the public. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now, this lodge in Philadelphia, in order to put forth these ideas, we have two meetings a week. As now, on Sundays, the doors open at 10:30. The meeting goes from 11 until 12. For this month, and we will not have any Sunday meetings the month of August, but we will still have the Wednesday meetings. So this month and in September, we're looking at Mr. Judge's aphorisms on karma. Today we are looking at karmic magnitudes, and next week we are looking at karma of the earth. On Wednesdays, we just recently started our study in the Bhagavad Gita, and that will run from July through September. And the readings for both of these classes you can find at the book table. We do have a library that is open from 5:15 until 7:15, with the meeting starting at 7:30 until 8:30. The library is a reference library, and you are welcome to come in 5:15 to read and prepare for that night's class. And if you want any kind of an independent study, there is always a librarian available in order to help you find the literature that you need. We have a book table in the foyer that also has all the straight line theosophical writings available, and it's only at cost of printing and shipping. The United Lodge of Theosophists is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings and time and work. All are invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. So today, we hope everybody has the aphorisms for today. We will be looking at numbers 5, 6, and 7. And what we're going to do is we'll read the three of them at once, and then we'll go back and look at each one separately. We can do a discussion, and then at the end we can open it up to any questions on the aphorisms at all. So number five is, karma operates on all things and beings, from the minutest conceivable atom up to Brahma, proceeding in the worlds of men, gods, and the elementals. No spot in the manifested universe is exempt from its sway. Six, karma is not subject to time, and therefore, he who knows what is the ultimate division of time in this universe knows karma. And seven, for all other men, karma is in its essential nature unknown and unknowable. So we'll do a discussion on number five first. Karma operates on all things and beings, from the minutest conceivable atom up to Brahma, proceeding in the three worlds of men, gods, and the elemental beings. No spot in the manifested universe is exempt from its sway. So that's a really huge kind of an idea, that karma affects everything. And we want to put it out to the group then. I mean, how can that be? What is, how does this work? Yes.
Well, we just think we put it in terms of, it's a universal law. It's not a particular law, but it's a universal law. It's the law of equilibrium, balance. So, it's not just one thing. It's like in 7, it says, you know, we can't know what it is. So the only other thing that we determine that way is the unknown, is the absolute. So we think that it operates in that kind of universal way.
And karma is like the wind, almost. Because you can't see, we were thinking about this the other day, you can't see the wind. You can feel its effects, but you can't see it when it's blowing by, but you can see the trees blowing. And karma's the same way. You can't see it, you can't touch it, but we feel its effects. And as said, it's a universal law, but it also, when we look at karma with action and reaction, it does affect the particulars as well, but it affects everything too. Did you?
So, karma works on everything, like it says, from the minutest conceivable atom up to Brahma. And of course, we have unselfconscious beings that are below human, and then we have fully conscious beings, fully actualized, which are above us, perfected human beings, and then up to Brahma. It's really daunting, but when we figure that karma is action, and that everything is alive, then if it weren't this way, then there would be such a thing as dead matter. And the philosophy says that there is no such thing as dead matter, that everything is sentient on its own plane, has its own degree of consciousness. So this is another way of saying everything is alive. And there is no dead matter.
Right, so there is no dead matter. And this idea of karma working on all, on everything, is one way of justifying that. And we do want to just mention, in regards to the worlds of men, gods, and the elemental beings, how, you know, we wonder, because it says the atom, you know, it affects the atom. How can karma affect the atom? But when we look at karma regarding man, we have free choice. We have free will. So in regards to karma affecting us, we are making the action based on what we are thinking, how we are acting. We know that if we do A, that B is going to follow. We know that what we do today will affect what we do tomorrow, because we have these choices. So karma wants to balance. That's what it's there for, is to balance the universe. And if we do something negative, karma, that's what it's going to do. You will be affected at some point in time in the future, because karma needs to balance the universe. When we're looking at the lower kingdoms, though, they don't have those choices, whether it's from the atom up to the animal. They don't have the choices, because they are not self-aware. So what kind of karma do they have? Well, they have, it's like a group karma. It's like when you have a dog, it is a member of the canine family. It's not going to make those ethical and moral choices that man does. Although sometimes it does seem like they are doing that, but we know that the way they are thinking is not the same way that man thinks when we make our moral and ethical choices. But as a group, each animals, you know, the cats, dogs, lizards, whatever, those groups have their own group karma, and when they die, they will go to a higher level of animal. And this will go on until the time comes when they will be, when the form will be ready for them to become self-aware as man is. And when we're looking at, like, what we call karmaless beings, people think about the masters and the adepts. They know what can cause, what will result in karma. So they are able to see, and we will be getting to that with the next one about, well, why don't we go on to that one, unless anybody has any more questions on the first one. Yes.
Who or what is Brahma?
Well, Brahma is the, how can we put it? Yes.
Can we clarify one thing? The way this is spelled is Brahma.
Brahma,
so it's
right.
So Brahma, which is the absolute.
Thank you.
Brahma, where the last name has a hat, that's the first emanation.
The first emanation. Thank you very much. There you go. Yes, in the back.
It's understood, I understand that the three fundamental propositions based on the best way to proceed, to state and use in our discussion the term be-ness and be-me. Therefore, how could a be understand or know all of be-ness?
How can a being understand being-ness?
Encompass it in its understanding.
Well, can you speak that last part a little louder, right, please?
Venus and being manifestation of the various units tell us right away that these fundamental ideas are the best place to begin to understand that law of action and reaction and its importance. Could you give us an understanding on how to proceed from that first proposition to the second one, which we understand is coming, the law?
So you're asking what is the relationship between the first fundamental and the second? Basically? Okay. Well, the first fundamental is the idea of deity, which we cannot conceive of. When we're talking about beingness and being, it is beingness because it cannot be really conceived of, where it's not an anthropomorphic idea. It's like space, we say. It cannot be conceived of. There's no, it's out there. And we are that deific essence. We have a spark of it And it is what binds us together as humans when we look at the idea of universal brotherhood, because we, as well as the lower kingdoms have a spark of this beingness in it as well. So it binds the entire universe together, so that when we speak of one being injured or hurt, it affects everything. So if we're looking at how then with karma is an expression as well of this deific essence. It is law. It is what affects everything, as was said. And we can't explain it either. We just know that karma is. And as we said, it's like the wind. We can't see it, we can't touch it, but we feel its effects. So why don't we then go on, since we kind of brought it up about, we could probably do 6 and 7 together. Karma is not subject to time, and therefore he who knows what is the ultimate division of time in this universe knows karma. And 7, for all other men, karma is in its essential nature unknown and unknowable. So unknown and unknowable, that's like, that's also a description of deity, isn't it? So when we're looking at this idea of karma is not subject to time, part of what we could say is that what we're doing now, what we're experiencing now, doesn't necessarily have to come from the exact previous life. It could be something that has been, it's a reaction to something that could have been experienced thousands of years ago. And what we're looking at now and what we are doing now and how we react to others, if there's any kind of a negative connotation to it, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to come back to us in the next life. It could happen 2 or 3, 4, 5, 6 lives down, even more. What happens is that when after we're done with the after-death states, the soul will has a view of what's coming up. Just an overall view, nothing specific. But what it is being pulled back to manifestation of the world, of the experiences that will be best for those lessons that need to be learned in that lifetime. So, depending upon what we're doing now, and the thing that is comforting that we need to remember is that those folks that we have a tight bond with, that we love, at some point in time, we will be coming back with them as well as those that we have maybe a little bit of a disagreement with. We have to come back and work that out too. But those that we love, we will also come back with them. So we think that in regards to the philosophy, to us, that's a very comforting idea. Yes.
With respect to number six, that, and therefore even knows what is the ultimate division of time in this universe, knows karma. What might be helpful is we recall that HPD said that when she refers to the universe, the theosophy, in her writings, generally we should accept it as she's talking about our solar system. That's one thing, which is kind of interesting. So that kind of brings it a little closer. And also, it's been a long time since we've read it, this particular, but we know that in Answers to Questions, Mr. Crosby talks about this statement about the ultimate division of time, and it has to do with the original vibration of the universe, the creation and the formation of the universe. So it is knowable, because remember, he says, for all other men.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially, it's unknowable. But it is knowable by man. It's just, it may be unknown to us right now. So it might be helpful to realize that we're not going to go from complete ignorance to absolute knowledge of it, but there's going to be a continuum. So there's no, so to speak, unknowable mystery. It's just how much of the mystery can we come to fully mm-hmm. know through our own effort. So let's not look for a reason not to bother with it, because probably the more we investigate it, the more we'll learn about it, and the more we'll be able to use it.
Yes, and the more we progress, the more that we are perfected as we move along our journey, as was said, we will become more aware of what those time, the ultimate divisions of time are. And we know that the masters are aware of what those divisions of time are, that they can determine what will happen. Well, not what will happen. They don't make it happen, but they can see what can happen. And that for us, as was just said by the comment, at some point we will become more aware of those divisions in time that karma will follow. Yes.
Sort of hints that we get, like the zodiac. We always wonder what that meant, what meaning is behind it. And it's a clock of time,
mm-hmm.
and recurring events,
mm-hmm.
and also what expanded time for me was the chart that's found in the ocean of theosophy on the four ages and the length of years that are included and so our period of time in the West is somewhat limited toward these ancient cultures who had plotted time and mm-hmm. calculated time for trillions and trillions of years. So when we think of time, it's sort of
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's meditation on the abstract.
And when we think about time, like that chart in the ocean, when you see these, you know, the breakdown and all the millions of years, it's like it's hard to conceive. It's hard to wrap your mind around that much of time. And yes.
Yeah, that chart in the ocean is very interesting because it gives you an idea of just how immense these cycles are. And we're given hints as to what to expect in those cycles, as in this cycle, the Dark Age, the Kali Yuga, the Iron Age, it's also known as, that everything is upside down and topsy-turvy. Those that are actually of a low natural caste are in high places, and those that are would be of a high caste are in low places. So everything is thrown into chaos, as it were. But it's not for the whole period. That there's cycles within cycles. And that, we think, is what ultimate division of time is. And we're not told about that. We're given just a sketch. And, you know, it's interesting to play with the numbers because they all add up to 9, every single cycle, including the great cycle of the life of Brahma. But we're not given the real knowledge, because then we could, at our point of development, we would use it and misuse it, and it would be dangerous. It would be like dynamite in the hands of children.
When Mr. Judge talks about this ultimate division of time, we're not really, we don't know that we're really aware of what exactly he's meaning when he talks about this ultimate division in this universe. We know it has to do with karma, and karma and reincarnation, as we know, are part of the second fundamental of law, of cycles. And it is karma, and when the zodiac was mentioned, we're given ideas of how these cycles return, the return of impressions. So did somebody have a... Yes.
Well, one way that HPV describes what time is, she says that it is, one way she describes it is it's a series of progressions of your unfolding consciousness, which, let's just use the word spiritual evolution or something. So if we look at it from that perspective, well, karma is not subject to our spiritual evolution. If we do something, we do something. It doesn't matter how much we advance, it's going to come back around. We're going to have this opportunity to learn from it. So karma is not subject to our spiritual evolution. Therefore, he who knows what is the ultimate division of spiritual evolution, he who knows what the progression of the human race is or his own, knows the ultimate division. I guess what we're saying is we don't know, typically, what stage we're at, how far we've gone, how far we've come, but there are those who can look at us and know that. And those who can know our development, perhaps that's what they're saying. They know the division of time. And it actually correlates to Mr. Judge's statement that the soul evolves along the same path, according to the same methods of the very sun in the center of our solar system.
We were thinking that in regards to the idea of he who knows what is the ultimate division, we were thinking along the same way, that those are the ones who know our progress and know they're the ones that have also been behind certain events that have taken place in history. And they're also the ones that when we are in Devacon and they need another companion to come and help sooner, they are the ones that know that we have reached a certain point in our development that we can be of service, and they are able to bring us out of Devacon sooner than the usual average of 1,500 years. So those who know are the ones that know about the ultimate division of time. They are the ones that are aware, and we are on the same path that they are. And it says, for all other men, karma is in its essential nature unknown and unknowable. And at this point, we are only aware of the effects that we are bringing to us, to ourselves, and that whatever comes to us is what we have created from past actions. Yes?
Well, the very point of creation is that it's done in the very moment. It's not done in the future. It's not done in the past. It's how we process things in the moment. That if we're caught up with thinking about this or thinking about that, we're not being in the moment. Mm-hmm. So there's another point that I wanted to make, that basically, you know, with that point you made, that we create everything that comes to us. But as far as this cycle is concerned, we are quite fortunate. We are very fortunate because 5,000 years ago, the Bhagavad Gita was given to us. Mm-hmm. Then in the last, in the 19th century, these esoteric teachings were given forth to the West and back to the East. And it said during this time of great material darkness that there is more force and power behind that effort made on the spiritual side, that it will bring forth, you know, sevenfold the effort put into it. So that's our good fortune. Mm-hmm. We just have to motivate ourselves to do that.
We are fortunate, and we've all been reincarnated here together for a reason. And the fact that we have been given these ideas that have been written down is definitely something that we have earned. We can't say, like Christianity, oh, it's such a gift. No, we earned to be here now. We have earned to have these ideas in writing that we can take home with us, that we can study, that we can talk to each other, we can have these classes, and we're not going to be subject to prejudice because of what we believe. So we have, even though this is considered the dark age and it's very materialistic, we can also make greater gains. So if we need to take hold of these ideas and try and spread broadcast them, because we have a huge opportunity to put these ideas out. Did you want to follow up? Did you have your hand up? Oh. Yes.
We make it very difficult when we consider those three fundamental ideas.
Can you speak louder, please?
When we consider those three fundamental ideas, the aim and the purpose, it is the law of growth. Responsibility and growth when it reaches the human stage. And that if we keep in mind that fire burns and water wets.
What was that?
Fire burns.
Oh, fire burns.
Water wets.
Okay.
That's just a simplification of action and reaction. And when we get a grasp of the harmony involved in this idea of law and evolution, growth from within without, well, the law guides it. So man has a responsibility for all the other parts of nature by his thinking and acting according to the law of harmony. What is meant by that? Harmony.
What is meant by the word harmony? We think harmony is, there's the musical harmony where things are, the vibrations are such that there is no clashing of the notes of the music. And we can use that in regards to humans as well, that the vibrations are harmonic, that we can think alike. And if we don't think alike, at least emotionally, and when we look at the ideas of ethics and morals, that we can understand what other people are thinking, and we can accept if they're different. Yes? Excuse me, could you speak up a little bit?
The related word for that would be equilibrium.
Yes.
Harmony, equilibrium. They're very closely related.
Yeah, the idea of equilibrium and is the same that goes along with harmony, too. In the back?
Yeah, years ago, a word was coined that spells it out very quickly. It's called carmony.
Carmony?
Carmony.
Well, we've never heard of carmony, but that is an interesting meld of karma and harmony. Thank you. You had your hand up?
Yes. With the idea that we are so ingrained in competition, that the idea of cooperation is really sort of new and refreshing, and that we see that changing in our society. There is, of course, the competition, but we're finding that cooperation is the only way we're going to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes to what the comment I had to make before is about all of this doesn't mean anything if you don't use it and make it an active ingredient in your life.
Mm-hmm.
However, you may want to do that, but it's like just considering the idea all day long, because every few moments you go back and you think about it again. Or you're focused, you're centered, just on an idea all day long. And and that's making this a living power in your life. You have to put it to use, and both mentally, physically, and emotionally.
Yes, the idea of taking these ideas and putting them out to other people, and most of all, taking it inward and making it a power in your life. But then some people are checked by karma in regards to what they're able to do and how much they are able to understand. So there's a give and take here about what we can understand and what we're able to do, depending upon what karma has given us. Is this a follow-up?
Yeah, that sounds like an excuse that, you know, you're checked by your karma. We're all checked by our karma. We would be gods again. You know, but we're just struggling in this quagmire that we've created. And so, our whole life is predicated on our karma, or those causes that we have set in motion that we're now feeling the effects of. That's why when
when we read the Gita, we come to understand how he did it, and how we can undo it.
Yeah, the idea of being checked by karma isn't necessarily a death sentence in regards to what somebody wants to do. Say there's a person who wants to be, you know, a musician, but maybe there's something, they were born with something wrong with their hands. So when somebody's checked by karma, humans have the idea of free will. And if they are unable, for whatever reason, mentally or physically, unable to do what the desires of their heart would be, then how they react to that situation can determine in the future what the karmic response would be. So if somebody is checked by karma, doesn't necessarily mean that they can't do something else. But the whole idea is their motive and their acceptance of what it is they can't or can do. Yes?
I have a question. Say that you were like drinking a lot of your life or taking drugs and you did some bad things, but when you don't. Like, how does karma deal with that? Does karma look at it like, okay, the guy was drinking? Or does karma look at it like, okay, you got to pay for that bad in the next life? Because they... Do you get like a protective shield during that time period, or what's the osophy?
Well, in regards to addictions, whether it be drugs, alcohol, food, or whatever, those are choices. I mean, there is the idea that addictions are physical in nature. But a person still has the choice to stay away from whatever it is that they're using. So what transpired during that period of time when they have been using, they have to pay for that. And if you have stopped using and you are mending your ways and you're trying to do good with the right idea, with the right motive, then you still in a future life have to pay for whatever it is that you have done. But the fact that you are changing your ways, your thinking, your actions into a positive life, then, you know, you're creating what they call good karma as well. But you have to pay for what it is you've done in a life, because we do have choices we can make. Yes?
Well, also when it comes to addiction, I think that probably the addictions of alcohol and drugs are very different from food addictions, in the sense that if one continues to drink and causes all of these problems and doesn't stop drinking and the effects of the problems come back, it's just a continuous downward spiral. But if one stops drinking and the effects start coming back, the way you're going to handle those effects are completely different than if, because you're just operating from a different place. So one of the things, as we understand, is like, with, for instance, with Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a big thing about going to all the people that you probably affected in negative ways and apologizing and taking responsibility. That's a spiritual act. That's an act of empowerment. What our concern about AA is that we think that, you know, we've heard regret, that, well, really, I can't stop, so I'm going to turn it over to God. That is a concern theosophically speaking, you know? But with regard to this view on karma, as we try to understand what karma, you know, he who knows what the ultimate division of time is in this universe knows karma. Well, if like we said, time is related, and HBB said actually, as a progressive series of moving consciously through higher consciousness or something. Well, step one, no matter what your karma is, step one, if you're a subconscious thinking being, is considering the idea, am I this bundle of emotions, addictions, and physical stuff, or am I an immortal, spiritual, powerful being in my essential nature. So for he who wants to know karma, step one has to be to make the effort to at least test that idea and try to get to know him or herself in his or her true nature. And it's, you know, it's baby steps in that direction. Who knows how far one gets in any one given life? But the effort is what matters. That's setting karma in a completely different direction.
And we also think that part of this idea of beginning one's journey from addiction, whether it be drugs, alcohol, and we think food can be a real, real issue with some people, that just being aware that there is a problem, that that addiction is affecting not only your life, but the life around you, can be the beginning of, you know, this positive spiritual journey. And you know, it is baby steps. It takes a long time, and one definitely has to look inside and know that they are, as was said, that they are a spiritual being, and that not only you, but everybody, everything is spiritual in nature. It's just that everything is on a different time frame when it comes, different level. In the back.
And the baby steps and the right motive are the answer to mitigating karma.
Yes, as long as we are doing it with the right idea, that we can definitely make for a more positive outcome for the future for us. Yes.
Well, we're thinking in terms of a statement made about having in your life addiction or proclivity of not having self-control, and whether it be appetite or whether it be visually, you know, things that you like to look at, you know, there's all kinds of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as what we've done in the past, we have no control over that. That's done. The only thing we have control over, we don't have control over the future. We do if we have control over the moment, the present.
Mm-hmm.
That's why reading the Gita is so very important, because you become focused in the present. You are not looking at things how you would like them to be, or how it's affecting me, or am I doing better, you know, am I changing? That's all unimportant, because you're not in the moment. When we're in the moment,
mm-hmm.
that's when we have our realizations. That's when we have our epiphanies. That's when we have our most deepest connection with people. When we just let it all go and just be present. Even when we have close friends dying, there's nothing you can do but be present. Be present and witness.
And we know, in regards to being in the moment, we know that Buddha has we read about Buddha saying about being in the center, being, not being excessively high, not being excessively low, but being in the moment and experiencing that. The Gita is, and which, for those of you who don't know, we are studying now for the fall, for the summer. The Gita talks a lot about not expecting results from your actions, but just doing it because it's your duty and it's that which needs to be done. And karmically, your duty is what is coming to you that you have created in the past. That is your duty. And accepting that as something that needs to be corrected and something that has to be accepted as this is what I have wrought on myself. Yes.
This is just one aspect of the Gita. I understand that. But I mentioned it because you mentioned it. There are those, and if I'm not, maybe you, I think I'm correct in saying this was Gandhi's, Mahatma Gandhi's idea of the Gita. That resisting, there is a place, and this is where I'm in conflict, for conscientious objection, for saying no. Now, this has always posed a problem for me. And what is the karma of one who says, I will not fight? I will drive an ambulance, whatever, but I will not fight. What is that karma? Or doesn't that apply to theosophy?
Well, we can't see into somebody's heart. So if somebody says that they're going to be a conscientious objector, we really don't know what their true motive is as to why they don't want to do it. But the fact that they are willing to serve, but they're willing to serve in another capacity, we don't know I'm going to put it out because we're not, I mean, we know what it says in the Gita because we know that Arjuna was of the warrior class. But his reasons for not fighting might be different from, you know, a conscientious objector's reasons. So we don't know that we can actually say exactly what theosophy would say, but we have to look at somebody's motive. Yes?
Well, can we look at the reality that the Bhagavad Gita is about a war, but it's not an external war.
Right.
It's only that's a reflection of the war that's going on within every human being, between the higher and the lower self. There can be peace, but one has to endeavor to lead a life in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Arjuna, that was his duty, because in the world in which he lived, that was his class. But we now live in a society, in a world where all the castes are mixed. And that war is not, we have not come to understand why it exists. We still are fighting them because we have disagreements or we have mm-hmm. power struggles with other people. And there's not this kind of understanding that we're all one and that we're all in this together and that harmony and cooperation are what is going to advance us as a humanity, not war and not all the selfish acts that are perpetrated by war. So, conscious anxious objectors is just really within the system. Yes, but morally, no. I will not kill another human mm-hmm. being. Morally. But, you know, that's an individual choice. And how one struggles with that and how one confronts it is also an individual choice.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
If we look from the perspective, though, of the Gita as every one of us is Arjuna fighting his inner battle. He who decides, no, I will not fight, that by its very nature is a tamasic, heedless approach. And there's karma to not doing the duty. But at a certain level of development, even if a human being says, no, I'm not going to fight this war, it's not worth my effort, if he's already made certain commitments in prior lifetimes, he's not going to have a choice. Conditions are going to be around him that he's going to have to do the work on himself anyway, because he's going to be controlled by his higher principles.
Yes.
But I think the point is that if we do not face that battle within us, that battle manifests itself outside of us. If we do not confront it internally, it will manifest itself externally. And we see that all over the world, and with ourselves, and with our friends. You know, if you do not deal with that in your own very nature, you're struggling in life.
Mm-hmm.
You're in conflict constantly. You're annoyed. You're upset. You know, there's always problems everywhere around you. And you look on the dark side. You have to look on the light side.
So as we can see with this idea of whether to fight or not to fight, there's many, many different parts that go along with it, because we're looking at what karma has brought forward into your life as to whether you will have to fight at some point in time, or it's has come as a situation where you have to make the choice as to whether you're going to fight or not. And then we're looking at the moral idea of what is your true motive, whether to fight or not to fight. So this is such a huge topic, and class is almost over, but it certainly is something that we can all think about, because there's so many different aspects to it. But the main thing is karmically what comes to you in regards to if there's an issue with you going to war or not, you have to look inward and see where that answer is going to come. In the back.
So throughout the whole Bhagavad Gita, it's a dialogue, and there's every angle is looked at. But in the end, it says, the choice is your own, to thy own self be true. So if one decides that they don't want to fight, they may not do any other work. They may go to jail and do nothing, or they might be put on a road crew. But that's their choice. And you need to be true to yourself to learn the lessons. Because if you're just following blindly, and we think that's how we get in a lot of trouble, is we're going to, you know, we need to learn the lesson and be true to ourselves. And, you know, we're eternal beings. This is just one blink of an eye, this life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we think in the Gita it also says, in the end, it's like, you know, do what seemeth best unto thee. So, our meeting is now over, and thank you.